Good morning. We're ready to proceed with the first case, U.S. versus Walker. And Mr. Fall, are you going first?
Yes, sir.
All right.
Good morning, and may it please the Court. Brian Fall, Federal Defender Services, on behalf of Neil Gladney. I'm here this morning to address the Pinkerton issue that affects the defense in this case. Now, I think we all know that Pinkerton expands criminal liability to hold defendants liable for the conduct of co-conspirators. But it also sets an outer edge to the conduct for which defendants may be held responsible. It's a principled edge, because to hold somebody liable for conduct that's unforeseen to them would run into due process concerns. So Pinkerton sets this principled edge. And courts follow this edge routinely when it comes to sentencing enhancements. For example, if a co-conspirator uses a firearm in furtherance of the conspiracy, a defendant will only be held liable for that conduct if that conduct is foreseeable to them. In the same statute as the death resulting enhancement, 841B, we determine that drug weight is only held responsible based on co-conspiratorial conduct if that's reasonably foreseeable to the defendant. So in the same statute here, 841B, which courts routinely hold that reasonable foreseeability is with drug weight, with similar language, the district court needs to find that in a conspiracy, a death resulting was a result of conduct that was reasonably foreseeable to a defendant.
And the conduct concern, from your perspective, would be heroin sale, wouldn't it? That others would be involved in the same distribution of heroin, or similar distribution?
It is heroin distribution, but it's not heroin distribution in general, Your Honor. I mean, because
so the heroin distribution of the organization that your clients pled guilty to
It's the heroin distribution that occurred that caused the death. Did that heroin distribution, was that foreseeable to this defendant? If you hold it to be just any drug dealing by the conspiracy, then you take away, you read out foreseeability from the Pinkerton analysis.
So a conspirator has to be able to anticipate each and every sale by others in the conspiracy? Is that what you're saying?
It has to be foreseeable to him. Not that I know that on this date you're going to sell X amount of heroin to somebody, but they have to know who that extra distributor is. They have to know, I mean, there has to be some relation.
They don't need to know the identity of the co-conspirators. That's not Pinkerton law.
No, they don't have to know, but they have to understand that, again, there's a difference between saying drug dealing in general, but drug dealing that occurred within the scope of the conspiracy that they're a part of, that they understand. If, for example, in this case, Mr. Gladney didn't join until 2008. So he's a member of a conspiracy that goes back even farther. So only conduct after that point, for example, could even be reasonably foreseeable. Then you also have a chain, I think, that's different here than the cases cited by the government, where it's person one deals to person two, deals to person three who dies. Here we have a long line of micro distributors who come from, who may not even know the existence of each other or the clients, anything about it, in so much that it's almost like separate conspiracies.
Let me ask you this. Are you familiar with the case out of the Sixth Circuit, the Sweeney case, which held that the district court must gauge whether or not each defendant was part of the distribution chain that led to the deaths in a heroin distribution conspiracy?
Yes, and I think...
Do you think that case is applicable here?
Yes. I think what the a lot of these cases, they don't seem to address the application of Pinkerton 2841B, but what they all seem to be talking about is foreseeability in some sense. And I think you need to demonstrate that there is a link in the chain and that somehow each of these defendants was somehow linked to the distribution that ultimately caused the death. And I see that I'm out of my time for now.
All right. Thank you. Mr. Hunt.
please the court. Justices, my name is Edward Hunt. I represent...
And we're judges, not justices here.
I like that promotion.
Yeah, you like that. Especially since you can skip confirmation.
Yeah.
I represent Keith Walker, the hapless 18-year-old Keith Walker, who even by the government's own admission, by everyone's agreement, is just a kid who's working the phones every once in a while. He is, by all accounts, a small-time nickel-and-dime operator. He gets held responsible under the current state of the law as it's applied, strict liability, for the deaths of four people on proof that amounted to no more than just autopsy and protocols. We're talking, of course, about Tomaszewski, David Nuth, Joshua Carroll.
Do you think they died of something else?
Judge, frankly, what they died of under the strict liability, if the government says, well, there's some heroin or drug overdose component, someone like Keith Walker, who is so far distant, gets held responsible as high as someone like Stewart or Johnson that are kingpins. Now, I
it's a dangerous drug, though.
It is a dangerous drug in a very specific sense,
and 841B is somewhat selective in terms of which drugs carry this risk. Right? It's not just any controlled substance.
No, it's 841B1A, though, has been applied to other drugs as well, though, Your Honor, other than
sure,
heroin.
The specifically listed drugs, but not just every drug.
Right. But, you know, Judge,
certain drugs carry with them greater risks than others.
Right. And
you gotta stay in front of there.
I'm sorry. You are correct. Certain drugs carry greater risks. But to hold someone of Keith Walker's involvement strictly liable, when, frankly, the government, by its own concession, and it's honorable that Mr. Sanders makes this point, concedes, as Hatfield, which is the cornerstone of why I am here today, Hatfield is my springboard, so to speak, strict liability leads to strange results. What happened to Keith Walker is a strange result. And due process and its perhaps most famous doctrine, as far as I'm concerned, the fair notice doctrine as it relates to criminal law, should put someone on greater notice of what guilty mind and what bad act are married. To say that a Keith Walker, who's just working the phones and is a worker bee, should be held responsible for debts down the road when there's no relationship that he has with those people is unfair. And I point out one other thing. If you take a look at Robinson, Dela Cruz, that list of cases which the government cites in their and Webb, which does a nice litany of the cases, all of those cases, the defendants were closer to the debts. You could, unfortunate to say this about them, you could see it coming. You can't say that with Walker, and that's the danger of this type of strict liability. Now, I realize that Congress...
No, go ahead. Finish that.
I'm sorry. I realize that Congress has said, well, we have other strict liability statutes. That doesn't make it right. And I think Judge Posner's concerns in Hatfield are right on the money here. And here's the difference between Hatfield. No one challenged the statute. We are as applied.
So let me ask you this. Why shouldn't we adopt the Sixth Circuit standard, getting back to the Sweeney case, which says that the government has to prove the defendant participated in the distribution chain that led to a person's death in a heroin distribution conspiracy? That's distinguishable from strict liability, at least as the Sixth Circuit saw it.
It may be, and unfortunately, Judge, I apologize. I haven't read that case, so I can't give you an adequate discussion, but I see where you're coming from. But not to be a troublemaker, but I don't like strict liability in statutes. And I think Judge Posner is right on that point.
All right. Thank you.
Thank you.
Mr. Gerstein.
Good morning, judges.
Good morning.
My name is Michael Gerstein. I represent Jermaine Stewart. Although I have a lot of issues, I'm going to address one with the limited time I have. Rule 11. Here you've got the government saying, on one hand, it's in the plea agreement that the mandatory minimum that Stewart has signed, the plea agreement, is either 10 years or 20 years. So when there's the colloquy between the judge and the defendant, judge asks him, you understand the mandatory minimum? He says 10 years. But we know that under the strict liability standard that the judge imposed, the mandatory minimum was 20 years. The government says, well, Rule 11 doesn't really matter in this case because there's a plea agreement. Well, there's a plea agreement in every case where there's a plea of guilty. Are we going to throw Rule 11 out and say, district judges, you don't have to literally comply with Rule 11. The mandatory minimum doesn't mean anything. If the mandatory minimum is 10 years or 20 years, who cares? I don't think we want to say that. I think we want to say to the district court judges, make sure that the defendant understands what the mandatory minimum is. Make sure the defendant understands that when he is pleading guilty to a certain crime with a certain minimum and maximum sentence. I don't have anything else to say.
Any questions? All right. Thank you. Mr. Kinsler.
Thank you, and may it please the Court. My name is Brian Kinsler, and I represent Mr. Lund. And I wish I could take the balance of my colleague's time, but I... No, I can't.
You can do that.
In that case.
But you better be speedy. There's a sparsity of time this morning.
I will try my very best. Jason Lund conceitedly participated in a drug conspiracy by a thread, and for a very short period of time, he was essentially an accommodation buyer trying to score with he and his friends, like almost every other heroin addict has to. Almost none of them have enough money. Almost none of them know the right person at the right time. And for a while, Jason Lund knew the right person at the right time. And with other buyers, would put their money together, go to Milwaukee, and purchase from the conspiracy. Sometimes Jason Lund even had the phone number. But that ended at a point in time. First, Mr. Lund intentionally tried to overdose to commit suicide. That's abundantly well documented in the PSI at multiple paragraphs. If you can't check out of a conspiracy by trying to kill yourself, I'm not sure how one can. But then there was also a deal gone bad, and the conspiracy, Mr. Stewart, would no longer sell to Mr. Lund. Let me ask, and I ask the court questions not to be rhetorical or not to be ironic, but it's a genuine question, and I think it's a question this panel has to consider. How is one minimal participant to withdraw from a conspiracy if A and B conspire? A kicks B out of the conspiracy and says, I'm not doing business with you anymore. I'm not going to sell drugs to you anymore. Is that still two people conspiring? If B finds another way to purchase from A at some point through another party because B is an end user, is that in furtherance of the conspiracy?
Well, I think your argument would be better if it were simply to purchase. He, after his incarceration, hooked up a couple of other deals where he got a piece of those deals.
As does any end buyer when they contribute their money. But I think the court's comment is appropriate, and this is why. Mr. Lund would have loved to hook up his friends with heroin. Of course, he was an addict himself, and ultimately he was trying to hook himself up, to use Horowitz. He couldn't even get the phone number of Mr. Stewart without asking a government informant for that number.
But he knew who to ask.
Well, I don't know how many different people he asked, but eventually he found someone who was willing to give him the number. And after he got the number and tried to set up a purchase, Mr. Stewart wouldn't deal with him and had to have Mr. Getsky, the victim in this case, and Mr. Lund's friend, actually do the transaction. If Mr. Lund couldn't get in touch with a conspiracy that he was allegedly a member of and had been kicked out of, essentially, had to get a phone number from Ms. Hay, and couldn't actually make the purchase without the assistance of Mr. Getsky, who's the conspirator? Mr. Lund was helpless without the assistance of these people. If a minimal participant in a conspiracy has to withdraw, that is, affirmatively withdraw, if that's the only way one can end their participation in a conspiracy, does he have to serve notice? Is the government's cooperators, are they the only ones who can withdraw because they're actively cooperating? Isn't expulsion enough to end participation in a conspiracy? And once expelled from the conspiracy, is every subsequent purchase or every subsequent accommodation offense part of that conspiracy or within the scope of that conspiracy, or is it just a buyer-seller relationship? You know, whether or not one considers this withdrawal, I think, and I see the yellow light is on. May I finish my point?
You may.
Thank you. Surely, scope, acting within the scope of a conspiracy, is a solution to the problem between choosing withdrawal versus expulsion. Well, withdrawal, expulsion, if one considers the scope, surely there is a difference between participation in a conspiracy and participation in a purchase outside of that conspiracy. That's what we're saying happened here. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Ms. Quinn.
May it please the Court, Attorney Kathleen Quinn appearing on behalf of Gene Lawler. In this case, even Judge Stadtmiller had pointed out how the preponderance of evidence standard by which the enhancement here must have had to have been proved is quite low. We all recognize that, but it is a standard. I tell you, if you affirm the application of the sentencing enhancement in Ms. Lawler's case, it will be meaningless. That standard, low as it is, meaningless.
Well, let me ask you this, because I understand the argument that the testimony was untrustworthy, but then there were phone records that corroborated Jennifer's account that Jeffrey got the drugs from Lawler, and the court did rely on those records.
If I may, there was zero testimony, so there was no testimony whatsoever in this matter. All that the judge relied on was the representation within the pre-sentence report of cherry-picked statements among multitudes of statements that were given to law enforcement, interpreted by law enforcement, and regurgitated in the pre-sentence report.
And then the phone records were utilized to verify that.
Sure. The phone records were from only the 19th, 20th and 21st of December 2008, nothing from the 18th, a day on which Ms. Lawler could have been in touch with the Tubchevsky residence, a residence with whom she'd been familiar since the time she was in middle school. She'd been friends with Jeffrey for years. No records from the 17th, about the time that she believes that she sold him drugs. There were no records. I'm not saying no indication within the records of phone contact. No records. The only records that were obtained and given to the court for consideration was just on the 19th, 20th, and 21st. And those records, which showed connections between the Tubchevsky house, Jennifer Tubchevsky, Jeffrey's sister, who was a drug user and drug supplier to Jeffrey and back and forth, and a multitude of their friends, all of whom were users and distributors of heroin, showed that there was contact on all of those days. None of the records indicate who was talking on the phone on the 19th. Was it really Jeffrey talking with Ms. Lawler, or was it Jennifer, or was it one of the parents talking to her? We don't know.
Well, didn't Lawler admit to the police that she gave Jeffrey heroin 4 days before his death?
She certainly did, 4 days before his death. Now, for a heroin user, a guy with a job, maybe also a tax refund check that got to him, and certainly a sister who supplied him and connected him with persons to use heroin for the 3 weeks leading up to his death. He had other sources. And over the course of 4 days, a heroin addict, the likes of this young man, who had been using heroin for 4 or 5 years, addicted, according to his own mother, he would have had ample opportunity within 4 days. He had a car, he had a job, he had phones at work, he had friends, and he had a sister who helped supply him with drugs. So 4 days before, so what? I think that it would be very, very similar to the court's finding in the Robinson case, where Robinson sold to Bunger. Bunger sold to a male decedent and a female decedent. The female decedent, once Bunger had sold her the drugs, she died, and nobody saw her after he sold her the drugs. The male decedent was, after the drugs were sold to the male decedent and the female decedent, seen walking around town, had access to other people, and so the court said, we can't hold Bunger or Robinson, even by Pinkerton liability or foreseeability, even though he was in the chain of the drugs going to the female decedent, we can't say that he was in the chain of the manufacture or delivery to the male decedent, because that male decedent had other opportunities to be in touch with other people. So did Jeff Topchewski. He had a car, he had money, he had sources. And the evidence, or lack thereof, that the court relied on in this case, with no testimony, no ability to weigh the credibility of witnesses that eventually got around to accusing Ms. Lawler, it's just not enough.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Mr. Sanders.
Please, the court. Good morning. My name is Assistant U.S. Attorney Daniel H. Sanders. I represent the government in this case, and I was the trial prosecutor in the case underneath. First thing I'd like to address is the Sweeney case that Your Honor had brought up earlier. The Sweeney case is obviously distinguished from the litany or string of cases that talk about strict liability and the death resulting enhancement. The first thing that I would like to note is that none of the appellants in this case have the issue that they've raised about strict liability is that there should have been some foreseeability analysis for the consequence of somebody of a co-conspirator's conduct. And the cases are clear throughout all the districts, and including this district in the Hatfield decision, that we're not going to look at the consequence. That's a completely separate issue that they've raised, and now they're trying to attach this Pinkerton liability on the consequence of a co-defendant's or of a co-conspirator's conduct. Pinkerton applies to conduct. 1B1.3, jointly undertaken activity, applies to conduct, not the consequence. The death, or death that results from the use of a controlled substance, the death resulting sentencing enhancement, is a consequence. What Sweeney does is Sweeney takes the issue that hadn't been raised in these other cases through all the other circuits, including Hatfield, where instead of the drugs being transferred on down the line through a chain, the government indicted, and several individuals ended up pleading guilty to being part of the conspiracy, and then at the sentencing phase got tagged with the sentencing enhancement or the death resulting sentencing enhancement. The difference here is, first of all, the Sweeney case never talked about the statutory interpretation of the liability, of co-conspirator liability. It talked about 1B1.3, or guideline liability. Now, there's statutory penalties and there's guideline penalties. And we all know that there's a difference between the two. The statutory penalties are the minimum and the maximum penalties that Congress has set, and with very few exceptions, notably substantial assistance, the court has to sentence the person within that range and has discretion to do so depending on drug weight and other sentencing enhancements. Guidelines and that the statutory construct is set up for the public in general. The guidelines, though, has a different approach. The guidelines is we're going to look at each defendant individually, and we're going to make an assessment to see where they fall. And that's what Sweeney does. Sweeney is a discussion of how 1B1.3 the jointly undertaken activity, how that applies. And they're trying to say, the Sweeney court is saying, that that analysis should be done for the conduct of the co-conspirators in assessing the death-resulting enhancement. Now,
and isn't that the Pinkerton concept that to be responsible for the conduct of a co-conspirator, the co-conspirator's conduct has to be within the scope of the undertaking that one joined? Isn't that the heart of the Pinkerton concept?
Correct. But in either application, obviously the guidelines is a narrower view of what your liability would be or what your co-conspirator liability would be than Pinkerton itself. But both concepts are focusing on the conduct of the co-conspirator and not the consequence.
But that narrower concept of co-conspirator liability then opens the door to Sweeney, doesn't it? I mean, if you look at what Sweeney held, because we had very similar circumstances in terms of the distribution in Sweeney, very similar circumstances.
Yes, we do.
And if we adopt your position, won't we also be creating a circuit split?
Not necessarily, and this is why. I think, let me make a distinction about the Sweeney case and the facts that the court has before it with these particular appellants. Obviously, the government believes that Mr. Lund, Ms. Lawler, and Mr. Stewart were in the direct chain, so to speak, of distribution to the decedents to the victims who ultimately died through the heroin. So I'm not going to address that.
They're not
a Sweeney case. Obviously, the Sweeney case are Mr. Gladney and Mr. Walker, people who admittedly not only were they given notice in the indictment, but in the plea agreement, in detail in the plea agreement, that they were pleading guilty to a conspiracy that was distributing large amounts of heroin, and that they were the facts that they stipulated to, that they were distributors within that conspiracy, and that during the course of that conspiracy, at least five people died as a result of heroin distributed by that conspiracy. The facts in Sweeney are somewhat different in that those defendants were never put on notice in the indictment that death resulting would apply. There was nothing in the pre-sentence report, the initial pre-sentence report, that death resulting would apply. Nothing in the plea agreement. It only came up when the government filed objections to the pre-sentence report and laid this information on the court. It's not even clear from the Sweeney decision whether the court imposed a mandatory minimum of 20 years. They are talking in the context of the guideline application and level 38 under 2D1.
So your point is that if they have notice, then it's appropriate.
Well,
I mean, it's appropriate to hold them responsible. So is your bottom line then that, you know, a lookout should receive the same minimum sentence as a drug kingpin when a totally unforeseeable or bizarre death occurs?
Not necessarily, Your Honor, and I don't think that these deaths in this particular case were totally unforeseen or bizarre deaths. This is mass distribution of heroin that is either snorted or shot up intravenously. As the court, the facts indicate that on the record that a lot of these distributors and these end users had access to Narcan. This is a device or a medical device used that when people go into seizure from addiction, they can, or somebody else can, stab them in the sternum with it to inject them with adrenaline to bring them back to life. That has occurred in this case. Congress took notice of that, and that's why those penalties apply. The difference, I think, is what I'm saying, that the appellants have framed their issue, at least on this issue, into there needs to be some sort of foreseeability for the death resulting, the consequence. Court after court after court, and this court in Hatfield said, no, that's strict liability, just as the statute reads. It's unambiguous.
So
Pinkerton... Go ahead.
So You're saying then what they need to be able to foresee is that their co-conspirators would distribute heroin.
Absolutely.
Regardless of the effect of the heroin.
Absolutely. And the statute contemplates that with the normal Pinkerton liability that we would apply to co-conspirators for drug weight, gun enhancements,
So did Judge Stadtmuller make findings in that regard? What was reasonably foreseeable?
I don't believe he didn't make specific findings in terms of addressing the key phrases, Pinkerton liability, foreseeability, but he certainly made the findings within the record that at least for Mr. Gladney and Mr. Walker, the two that are really at issue here, that they were deeply, deeply involved in the conspiracy, even Mr. Walker. Mr. Hunt, the government would concede that Mr. Walker was not a distributor on the level of Jermaine Stewart or even Lonnie Johnson, one of the original distributors in this case. But certainly Mr. Walker had access to the phone every day. And the Waukesha distributors from Pewaukee and Muskego knew that they could call him, just like they could call Gladney, and just that like they could call Jermaine Stewart on any given day.
Given the amount of the penalty, not having specific findings by Judge Stadtmuller is problematic in terms of foreseeability at a minimum.
Well, I don't necessarily agree that Judge Stadtmuller didn't make he may not have addressed it specifically the way saying foreseeability, but certainly his findings indirectly make that.
Say a defendant distributes a drug that kills a person. If a co-conspirator has no connection to that drug transaction, has the co-conspirator done anything to cause the victim's death?
As in co-conspirator liability under Pinkerton liability, absolutely. This was a well-oiled machine. There were defendants in this case, of which Mr. Gladney and Mr. Walker were two, Jermaine Stewart and other defendants that were named in the indictment and unindicted co-conspirators that distributed heroin on a daily basis to people within Milwaukee and people in Waukesha County. They were integral. And on any given day, it could have been Jason Lund that contacted Mr. Gladney or Mr. Walker that got the drugs that ultimately went to Andrew Getsky and David Knuth and killed them. On any given day, when Jean Lawler got her drugs from Luke Bankowski, it could have been Luke Bankowski that didn't get a hold of Stewart, so then he called Gladney. Then he called Walker. The telephone records, as indicated in the record, indicate that the Waukesha distributors had numbers that were associated and used by Walker, Gladney, Stewart, and other individuals that distributed from Milwaukee out.
Well, you mentioned the Hatfield case because you rely on that a lot. But didn't we rely on a theory of causation to adopt the strict liability standard for the death resulting enhancement?
Well, when I refer to the Hatfield case, I guess it's the only case in the Seventh Circuit that has even remotely come close to addressing this issue. The issue in the Hatfield case is not the issue here. But in that decision, I think what Judge Posner said regarding Hatfield is, regarding causation is, hey, the government, you're trying to make it too complicated. This ling or string or litany of terms that you put in the jury instruction, the Hatfield case, you're confusing the issue. It's results from. It's a but-for causation. We don't need to go any further than this.
Well, if a co-conspirator did nothing to cause a death, why should that co-conspirator suffer such a severe penalty?
Because the co-conspirator is liable based on Pinkerton liability or guideline 1B1. Jointly undertaken activity.
But only for conduct that is reasonably foreseeable or something that's within the scope of conduct. For example, if they had conspired to embezzle money and a co-embezzler in the midst of it pulls a firearm out and shoots a bank employee in the head, that's not reasonably foreseeable.
Absolutely. I would agree with that 100%, Your Honor. But nothing in this case indicates that any of this distribution that ultimately went to the victims who died was unforeseeable. That conduct was unforeseeable. It's happened every day, multiple times a day. Sometimes the same distributors were coming into Milwaukee two or three times a day to re-up to go out and supply the people in Muskego and Pewaukee. And that completely And that's just the Pewaukee and Muskego people that were coming in. It doesn't even take into account the people from within the city of Milwaukee that were going to these to this drug trafficking organization daily to get their heroin fix. I would agree, Your Honor. Some of the examples have been used, and some of the cases cite them, of the drug trafficking conspiracy that exclusively deals in heroin. And for some reason, somebody finds a good deal on some ecstasy or some methamphetamine. And without consultation or notice to the other co-conspirators, whether they're couriers, distributors, sitting on the stash house, holding the money, or doing anything within the normal heroin trafficking conspiracy, they go out and they distribute the ecstasy or methamphetamine or something that's not within the agreement, direct or implicit, in the conspiracy, and that person dies. The government agrees. That would be outside the scope of the conspiracy. But there we're applying a foreseeability analysis on the conduct, not the consequence. And going back to Your Honor's concern about Judge Stabmiller not making specific findings, this court can look to the record to see if there's sufficient evidence. If you were to send this case down, I mean, there's sufficient evidence within the record right now to show the foreseeability on the conduct, and that the conduct was in the scope of the conspiracy for all these individuals, for all the appellants that are in here. I would like to address very quickly two issues, if I may, that were raised by, or a couple issues, Mr. Lund, Mr. Stewart, and Ms. Lawler. First, Ms. Lawler. Gene Lawler was one of those Muskego distributors, and the counsel for Ms. Lawler can argue about the facts. Judge Stabmiller looked at all these facts, looked at all the facts that the government presented and that she presented, and he made a credibility determination on all the facts together and said that she was inescapably involved in the chain, that the drugs that killed Jeffrey Topchesky passed through her hands. And I don't believe that, I mean, it's a determination made by the district court based on his personal, look, a review of the facts presented by both the parties. Mr. Lund, he wasn't kicked out of the conspiracy. He got caught. He overdosed on heroin. While he was in jail, two people died in the conspiracy. As soon as he got back out of jail, he got his quote-unquote, act back together and started taking people down to the drug trafficking organization to buy drugs. Now, whether or not the only thing that changed from 2005 when he started to when he went to jail in 2008 to when he got out, the only thing that changed was Stewart wouldn't take the money out of his hand for the transaction because he didn't trust him anymore. But if Lund brought down the other guy, unfortunately, two of them who died, and they handed him the money, he's perfectly willing to deal with Jason Lund. Took his call, told him where to met him there, sold him the drugs. End of story. As to Mr. Stewart, his Rule 11 colloquy, the plea agreement was clear. It said 10 to life for the drug trafficking conspiracy, kilogram or more of heroin. And then there was a proviso regarding the 20-year mandatory minimum regarding death resulting. We agreed to disagree. He specifically said, I'm not joining this recommendation. And the entire record is rife with Mr. Stewart's knowledge. He knew exactly what was going on. He knew. He wrote letters. Because counsel wasn't doing the things that they wanted him to do, such as getting his medical records to apply for disability, I mean, he was writing letters to the court. He was complaining about his lawyers. But he knew exactly what he was doing the entire time. And that's why Judge Stabmiller took the plea. That's why Judge Stabmiller found him guilty.
As far as the mandatory minimum,
yes,
other than Stewart, didn't everybody get less?
The mandatory minimum other than Stewart?
240 months.
No, Your Honor. All the appellants in this case received the death enhancement. Now, some of them received lower sentences
because of K-1 cooperation.
Absolutely.
Agreements.
Yes, sir.
So they're reduced for other reasons.
That yes.
And the mandatory, started with the mandatory minimum, I guess.
Well, a couple of them, Mr. Lund was above the mandatory minimum of 240, so it went down from the low end of his guideline below the mandatory minimum. Mr. Gladney was in the same circumstance. He was above the mandatory minimum in terms of his guidelines, swung down below the 240. Ms. Lawler and Mr. Walker started at the 240. Their guidelines were below the 240. So when they received their 5K, it started at 240 and went down. And it was roughly, well, it was more than what the government had recommended. The court gave them more based on their substantial assistance. Mr. Stewart did not receive a 5K motion. I see my time's up. Unless there are further questions.
Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you, Mr. Sanders. And I don't know how much time. But I will give you an additional minute, Mr. Fall, because this big issue is the Pinkerton issue. I'll give you an additional minute.
Thank you, Your Honor. I just want to clarify, it's not the consequences that we think have to be foreseeable. It's the conduct. But the difference between the government and the defendant appellants is I think the government thinks that all drug dealing is necessarily foreseeable. We think there has to be some determination of foreseeability made before particular drug dealing can be determined to be foreseeable. And as far as what the district court did on page 40 of the appendix, it's clear that Judge Daimler held that this was a strict liability and he wasn't not making any findings. Yes, there were plenty of facts in the record, but they weren't developed. The counsel came in knowing that this delay of the law was that this was going to be addressed as a strict liability and looking for him to address that. As such, defense counsel didn't address or raise concerns with some of the facts that they might otherwise have. In other words, no clear record was made as to foreseeability because the district court found, as a matter of law, they're going to be held strictly liable for this offense. And because no finding was made, I think that the defendant should go back for resentencing.
All right. Thank you. Thank you all, counsel, for your vigorous argument and representation of your client. We'll take the case under advisement and call the second case, Chicago Title.